everybody. Welcome to episode 460 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Marvel Monday episode. I'm going to be talking about a couple of the books that came out last Wednesday, August 8th, namely Fantastic Four number one. Yes, that's right. Marvel's finally producing a Fantastic Four comic again. And I'm also going to talk about Spider-Man Annual number one. So let's start with Fantastic Four. That's obviously the big one. They haven't put out a Fantastic Four title in, I think, about 3 years now. They kind of denied the reason why. They talked about sales, whatever. We really know the reasons why. And if you really want to know, the information's out there. I'm not going to get into it. I find it all to be completely ridiculous, but sort of par for the course with the way Marvel's run these days, unfortunately. So let's go ahead and dive into the issue. Give the creative team really quickly. There's multiple stories in the issue. The first one is written by Dan Slott with pencils by Sarah Pacelli, inks by Sarah Pacelli and Elizabeth D'Amico, and colors by Marty Garcia. The second story is also by Dan Slott with pencils by Simone, or actually pencils and inks by Simone Bianchi, and then colors by Simone and Marco Russo. And then finally, there's a one-page story from Dan Slott and Scotty Young with colors by Jeremy Treese. So for those who aren't aware of what's been going on with the Fantastic Four, spinning out of the last Secret Wars event that was in 2015 and bled into 2016 by Jonathan Hickman, basically at the end of that event, Reed Richards had the power to kind of put everything right, so to speak, or rebuild the Marvel universe, as it were. But it left him and Sue and their children behind in a way. They were living outside of reality, and we're not sure on exactly the details there. But when everything was said and done, we had the Thing and Johnny Storm back in the Marvel universe proper. We had Miles Morales back in the Marvel universe, actually, speaking of the other title I'm going to talk about on this episode. But Reed and Sue were nowhere to be found. And most characters in the Marvel Universe didn't remember the events of Secret Wars. So nobody was quite sure what happened to Reed and Sue and Franklin and Valeria. So because of that, there was no Fantastic Four. I think that Ben Grimm was a member of the Guardians of the Galaxy for a little while, and Johnny Storm was spending time with Crystal and the Inhumans, and then eventually they kind of teamed up, and they've been showing up in the Marvel 2-in-1 series that's been going on recently. I think that's by Chip Zdarsky, if I'm not mistaken. But the Thing believes that he doesn't really have the memories, neither does Johnny. And the Thing actually believes that Sue and Reed and the rest of the Richards family are dead. Johnny hasn't given up hope. He believes they're still out there somewhere. And that's where this issue starts, with the Thing believing they're gone and Johnny not willing to give up hope. So the issue starts with Alicia and the Thing at a farmer's market, and they're just kind of enjoying themselves while there's a woman there, the animal rescue, trying to persuade Alicia to adopt some cats. And the Thing is carrying the groceries, like, what do we need a bunch of furballs running around? Meanwhile, Johnny and Wyatt Wingfoot are at a Mets game, taking in the sights. And Alicia tells Thing, you know, I don't know, I thought someday we'd have pets. You know, they can't really have kids, so this would be the next closest. So Thing starts to come around to that thinking. Meanwhile, Johnny's on the Jumbotron at Citi Field, where the Mets play, and enjoying his celebrity as always. And then we see a Fantastic Four across the sky as someone fires off one of their classic flares. The city, everyone around, all see it, and they think, hey, it's the return of the beloved Fantastic Four. The Thing sees it. Johnny Storm sees it. And Johnny's smiling from ear to ear. He's like, I knew it. Duty calls. Wyatt's like, does that mean what I hope it means? And Johnny flies off saying, it means they're back. So the Thing still doesn't believe that it's actually the case and doesn't respond to the flare and walks off. And Alicia's following him saying, what's going on? I'm blind, not deaf. I heard what people are saying. There was a Fantastic Four signal. And the thing's telling her to drop it. But Alicia won't let it go. She's like, sit down and talk to me. So he sits down and he kind of pours his heart out. He says, you know, I've been keeping something from you, from everybody. And she says it's okay. She's there for him. He's like, it's not them. We got to stop hoping for a miracle. They really are gone. Meanwhile, the torch is flying toward the signal. People are leaning out windows saying it's about time. They're very happy for him. And Johnny's wondering who they're up against this time. Psycho Man, Diablo, the Frightful Four. He's ready for anything. Meanwhile, the thing is like, yeah, I know something that everyone else doesn't. I was there on our last big adventure. Reed, Sue, Franklin, Valeria, they're gone for good. Whoever set that flare off, it wasn't them. And sure enough, when Johnny gets there at the top of the building where the flare was fired from, it's some Yancey Street kids. And Johnny is pretty upset. He's like, this is a Yancey Street gang prank. And one of the kids says, I told him not to do it. And the other one's worried that Johnny's going to stick them in the Phantom Zone. So meanwhile, we get a news report saying that the reports are in and we can confirm that the Fantastic Four signal in the sky earlier was a fake. And she goes on to recap the way that they were transformed into the Fantastic Four. Reed Richards, Sue Storm, Johnny Storm, and Ben Grimm launched into space, bombarded by cosmic rays, transformed into their champions. And the reporter says that they reached out to the substitute members of the Fantastic Four for their thoughts on the prank, as well as the surviving members. The thing, of course, has no comment. Medusa believes that if there's any way they'll find a way home, it's because she has faith in Susan Storm Richards. Meanwhile, Crystal's saying that she worries most for Johnny Storm and Ben Grimm because it's a time of great pain for them. Luke Cage says it's a shame what happened to the kids, and it's what makes him determined to keep his family away from that kind of life. Jennifer Walters, She-Hulk, says that on the face the prank seems cruel, but the perpetrators are minors. It's a misdemeanor at best, and she's actually on her way to represent them. So we see at the police station, Johnny Storm is there with Wyatt, and Jennifer's talking about how it can probably all be worked out by hours or maybe days of community service. And Johnny's like, how could you represent them? They should be tried like adults. And Jen responds that three things. They're just dumb kids. No one was hurt. And it is her job. She was hired to defend them. And Johnny's like, hired by who? And Jennifer Walters says the thing. And Johnny's beside himself. He's like, what? It's like, yeah, he's also dropping the charges for breaking and entering. Think about it. How would a couple of Yancey Street kids get the flare gun in the first place? So when the thing goes to the little Fantastic Four museum that's set up, we find out that the caretaker probably forgot to lock the door. And sure enough, inside, we see the display case that held the original signal flare was broken. And that's how the kids were able to get in. But he does find an object that he had left there, and he's glad it's still there. And the caretaker's like, what's the story on that? I thought we were friends, but... And things like, okay, you dragged it out of me. Have a seat. This yarn's an oldie but a goodie. Let's call it one of the Fantastic Four's lost tales, because quite frankly, we was lost. So they were finishing up one of their outer space missions. They took a wrong turn. Luckily, they'd made a new friend named Astronomica. She knew her way around the stars. And they were at the crossroads of infinity, a pathway to every place in existence. And one heading will take them home, but the other will strand them a billion light years away. So they weren't sure how to choose. So Astronomica said that the Stellar X stone in her staff could light the way, but one of them must power it up first. So Sue says, well, which one of our powers do you need? And Astronomica said, it isn't about turning invisible or stretching or flame or strength. She needs to know which one is the best singer. And the thing says, yeah, did not see that coming, lady. That's ludicrous. And Reed Richards says, no, it makes perfect sense. All beings vibrate at the same quantum frequency as their home dimension. It only stands to reason that generating perfect pitch. And Astronomical's like, yeah, we're running out of time. Your best singer, tell me now. And everybody responds, from Sue, Ben, Reed, Wyatt, Alicia, Franklin, and Johnny. And all with the exception of Sue, they all say Johnny. And Johnny says, me. But of course, Sue says, it's me. And then she's like, wait, Johnny? Really? And the thing's like, sorry, Susie, but the kid's got the voice of an angel. And Sue says, Reed, you said you love my singing. He says, subjectively, yes. But objectively, as a scientist, I have to say, Johnny's timbre is, well, sorry, dear, I have to steer the ship, as he changes the subject. And Sue turns to Franklin, you know, nothing like a son's love for a mother, right? And he says, honey, you think mommy can, please, mommy, don't sing. So Sue says, fine. And it's up to Johnny, right? And so Astronomica tells him, as she hands him the staff, it's up to you, Johnny Storm. Clear your mind, open your heart, think of where you want to be, and sing. And he's like, no pressure, right? And so Johnny starts to sing Donkashane. And we see a glow in the sky. Reed says, it's working. Hold tight, everybody, coming about. And there it is, Central Park, New York City, right across the threshold. So they're home. They're home, all thanks to Johnny. And so the caretaker tells Ben, as he's relating the story, what? So for her troubles, you dragged that nice lady all the way to Earth? And Thing says, no, she and Reed figured out a way for her to pull a U-turn. But before she left, she gave me this as a gift, part of that magic gem. She said, if I ever got lost again, this would help me find my way home. Been lost for some time now. I've been without all of my family, without hope. But today I saw a real sign, and I know what they'd want me to do. I'm ready. It's time to go on my biggest adventure ever. Meanwhile, we see back at the apartment of Alicia. She did adopt a couple of cats. She's going to call them Rocky and Adrian. So that's a nod to the Rocky movies from Sylvester Stallone, if you didn't get the reference. And there's a knock on the door. She says, I'm coming. Hello. Hi. Hey, Alicia. And it's Ben. And she reaches out for him. She finds that he's kneeling. She says, what are you? He says, go to your right. Check your 3 o'clock. Baby, I ain't too good with words, but you know how much you mean to me. And now more than anything, you will always be the light that leads me home. So I got to ask, Alicia Masters, will you? And she screams yes, as Ben is down on one knee. He's made a wedding ring with that piece of stone that he got from Astronomica. And he's got a bouquet of flowers as well. And next we see the rooftop restaurant. I'm assuming that near Alicia's building. And Human Torch shows up saying, all right, what's the emergency? You said you had to see me right away. Is it about those kids and why you're putting up the cash to defend him? Wait, you're in a suit. Am I supposed to be in a suit? Are we going to court? And Thing says, no, it ain't like that. We want it. And Alicia tells him that they wanted him to be the first to hear the big news. And he says, what news? And she shows the ring. Ta-da! And Johnny's so happy for her. I said, I can't believe it. After all these years, you two are finally doing it. And the Thing says, that's not all, Matchstick. There's something else. Fate brought us together, and it's made us more than friends. We're family. You're like a brother to me, Johnny, so I'm asking, how would you like to be my best man? And Johnny's reaction is not exactly what Ben would hope. He screams out, no! And the Thing's like, what's the matter with you? And Johnny just can't let it go. He's like, no, it's all wrong. There's only one person in the whole world who should be your best man, and it's Reed Richards. And the Thing says, man, you're ungrateful. You ruined this beautiful moment. I'm gonna... And Johnny interrupts him, says, no, you don't get to be like that. You're the one who's lost faith. They're still out there. And the Thing says, wake up. We checked under every damn rock in the multiverse. Reed and Sue are gone. We owe it to them to go on living. And Alicia steps between them and says, boys, not tonight, please. Can we all just take a breath, calm down? I'm sure everything's all right. Johnny says, no, I'm done. I'm not taking this anymore, you hear me? And he flies up, says, do you, Reed? You're the smartest man in the universe. I know you're out there. I know you gotta have some way to see me or hear me. Just show me a sign. And he waits there in the sky and waits and waits and nothing. So he flies back down, and the Thing says, you can see the look on his face. He says, kid. And Johnny finally begins to accept it. He says, "It's true, isn't it? They're really gone." And he's got his tears in his eyes. And the thing says, "I'm sorry." Then as the scene shifts to some unknown alien environment, we see some kind of contraption. We see what's got to be Reed Richards based on his height and legs stretched out. And what I assume is Sue Storm's silhouette saying, "Is this really going to work? Your plan seems to do... What your plans do seems impossible." And he says, "One question, do you believe in me?" She says, "Always." He says, "That is why I can do the impossible. Here we go." And he flips a switch, and the thing and Johnny look up. The thing says, "Unbelievable." And Alicia wants to know what's going on. We see Crystal and Medusa look up. We see many citizens in the streets of New York look up. We see Luke Cage look up at the sky saying, "Sweet Christmas." We see Jen and Wyatt Wingfoot with Wyatt saying, "Oh yeah." And all Johnny has to say is, "It's about damn time." And in the sky above the Earth, that's got to be seen by everybody in the Northern Hemisphere, is a giant glowing four. Signal in the Sky is the name of this story. All right, so the second story, I'm not going to go into too much detail. I'll just say it has to do with Doom. Most recently, we saw Doom as the infamous Iron Man attempting to kind of trod the straight and narrow and be a hero for once. It did not work out for him. And in this story, he's finally stopped wallowing in self-pity, and it looks like we're going to see a return of the villainous Dr. Doom. Rather than the one that's tried to be a hero and then failed and has just been hiding out. But one big difference now, Doom seems to have superpowers of his own without the use of his armor. And then the final, I did mention there was a third story, one-page story, the final one by Dan Slott and Scotty Young. It's an Impossible Man story. It's 9 panels, and it's... talking about the fact that there is no Fantastic Four in this issue, technically. They're not together yet. But know this, in issue 2, the Fantastic Four will be back together in next month's issue. So issue 2. And the Impossible Man accepts that, but says that he'll be watching Marvel. So that's basically the issue. I won't say I was disappointed that... the Fantastic Four doesn't show up, that they didn't return, Reed and Sue and their children didn't return to the Marvel Universe proper in this issue. I was fine with it because I really feel like it was kind of necessary to give us some context and to kind of see where Johnny and Ben and the rest of the world were in terms of their feeling for the Fantastic Four and the fact that Reed and Sue have been missing. So I really feel like this is a great issue. And the fact that they're not going to drag it out, and we know for a fact that we're going to see the Fantastic Four together in next month's issue, is perfect. Plus, we actually did get them together, even though it was a flashback sequence in the middle of the issue. And it was cool the way Slott did it with, you know, everybody but Sue saying Johnny had the best voice, and Sue kind of, you know, protesting that in a way. It felt very, very much like a family. You know, you could definitely see families doing that. And that's one of the best things, one of my favorite things, and always has been about the Fantastic Four, is they're a family first more than anything else. And I feel like the best stories of the Fantastic Four, the best eras, have focused on that fact, where it has been the, you know, the original core four, if you will, rather than... like, I mean, it was fine when She-Hulk was there. You know, Crystal's been there for a while. And, you know, we've even seen what the Hulk, Wolverine, the Gray Hulk, Wolverine, Spider-Man, and Ghost Rider as a Fantastic Four for a few issues here and there. But really, it always needs to come back to the core four. Ben, Johnny, Reed, and Sue, that they're really the heart and soul of the Fantastic Four. And as much as they're superheroes, the Fantastic Four is more about being an adventure book, you know, with them exploring new universes, new realms, new possibilities. That's when the book works at its best. and when it focuses on the relationship between those four characters. So this issue was a lot about emotion and relationship and the way Johnny wasn't giving up hope, but the thing was, and seeing that giant four at the end really, really was touching the first time I read it. And it was like, yes, you felt kind of the relief and the excitement along with the rest of the characters that got to see that four for the first time. And it really worked. So kudos to Dan Slott for a very poignant issue. Also, the art by Sarah Pacelli was excellent. I hope these two stay together on the book for a long time because it has the right feel. And if they can kind of keep this tone and kind of keep this level of emotion and this family feel, I think they'll have a big hit on their hands. It'll be interesting to see what the sales are like for this title. Obviously, issue one's going to sell. Probably the first couple issues are going to sell really, really well, just based on the fact that, a couple things. The Fantastic Four haven't been around for a long time, so a lot of people are going to want to pick it up because they're curious how they're going to bring them back and what happened. Plus, there's like 48 covers for issue one, I think. So it'll probably be one of the better selling issues, not only of the month, but of the year, I would expect. So, but once that first arc's over, where does it settle in at? That's what'll be what I'll be curious to see. As far as the Doom story, it's kind of bringing Doom back to his status quo, just like we're bringing the Fantastic Four back to their status quo. I'm fine with that. I was never a big fan. It's been a big trend lately to turn villains into heroes or anti-heroes. And, you know, villains are villains for a reason, and I think they work well as villains. Doom has always been somebody that you could kind of see, kind of like Magneto, you know, where their intentions aren't necessarily evil, maybe misguided, maybe it's a lot ego, maybe they're self-centered and selfish, certainly, but not necessarily, you know, mustache twirling villains. But even saying that, you know, again, I'm not a big fan of turning Doom into a hero. I didn't actually read the infamous Iron Man series, so I can't really speak to that. But I'm happy to see that it looks like Dan Slott is turning Doom back into a proper villain. So that'll be interesting to see that and to see how he interacts with Reed and the rest of the Fantastic Four the first time they go up against each other, because I imagine it's coming sooner than later. So, I think that wraps it up for Fantastic Four. The other book that I want to talk about is Spider-Man, Annual 1. This is the Miles Morales Spider-Man. Let me give the creative team really quickly here. There's multiple stories in this issue as well. The first one is written by Brian Edward Hill. We've got art by Nelson Blake II with Alethea Martinez. We also have, because it's a flashback story, they handle the main art in the flashback, but there's also a present-day sequence, which is penciled by Mark Bagley with inks by Roberto Poggi, or Poggi, P-O-G-G-I. Colors are by Carlos Lopez and letters are by Corey Petit. So this issue opens up with Miles fighting Morbius, the living vampire. And then it immediately goes into flashback. And what's really cool is we see Miles... And it says years ago, flashback, Miles getting $500 from his birthday from his uncle Aaron, who we know is a criminal. But he also says it comes with some advice. And the advice is the same sequence of words that Miles is telling himself when he's fighting Morbius, the living vampire. Life isn't kind to heroes. You need to look out for yourself because no one else will. The damn world is broken down to its center, and anyone who teaches you that you can change it is either a liar or a fool. So the fact that Miles is reiterating those same words that he heard from his uncle years ago as he's fighting Morbius is interesting, right? You think, well, Miles is definitely a hero. You wouldn't think he would necessarily be echoing those words of his cynical criminal uncle. So next we see Miles goes to school the next day, and he has a mentor, You know, this is early on in the days where he's at this this school. What's it called again? Vision something? Horizon? Brooklyn Visions Academy, that's what it is. And so he has this this mentor there who's named Brent. And Brent asks Miles if he will do him a favor and go to this new limited edition pop-up store for some kicks and gear. He has tickets to the pre-opening, and Miles is like, I'm not sure I should go. It's really, thanks a lot. But Brent's like, really? Because my sister Olivia just transferred. She's in your class. She doesn't know anyone. You'd really be helping me out. So Miles agrees, and they eventually go there and come to find out this whole thing is set up by Genki, and he had reached out to Brent to see if Brent would hook Miles up because Miles doesn't do too well with the girls. And so they seem to be getting along pretty well, Olivia and Miles. But as Miles is trying on a hoodie, his spider sense goes off, and we see a Skrull ship crash in through the wall. We see a Skrull show up dressed in a policeman's uniform, and Genki once again is trying to convince Miles that he needs to help. He has what it takes to be a hero, and Miles gives in, says, "Find Brent and Olivia, tell them to stay down." He zips up the hoodie all the way to cover his face, dons some goggles, and fights the Skrull. And despite some reservations, he's able to defeat him with a sting from his spider stinger power. And then it looks like Spider-Man shows up, and he's very happy. He says, "Spider-Man, yes, I don't know what's going on. I think people are hurt bad in there. I mean, he's not a cop, but whatever he is, people need help." And Spider-Man replies, "It's all right, young man. There's no need to fear. All you have to do now is embrace change." And it's not really Spider-Man at all, but just another Skrull. So the Skrull grabs Miles, tosses him through a third story window. And Miles is telling himself, "Gotta get up, gotta get up." Meanwhile, Genki is being threatened by the Skrull. Miles shows back up, manages to get the Skrull to leave Genki alone and come after him. But he's definitely losing the fight. And as Miles looks up in the air, he sees one of the Skrull's spaceships as Thor flies through and destroys it. And that kind of inspires Miles. He's like, "Man, all I've got to do is beat one of them. It's just one Skrull. He's just going to kill, or he's going to kill your friends. I can't do this, but Spider-Man could. So I'm the only Spider-Man they've got. I've got to do it." So he does manage to defeat the Skrull by pretty much just staying out of his way the whole time and landing a few lucky punches. And then once the Skrull is tied up, he goes back inside the store. He sees Olivia cradling her brother and says, "Is he okay?" And Olivia responds, "He's dead," screaming, "He's dead." And Miles is even, and this is great art, because even though he has the mask on, there's something about the way the face is rendered. You can tell just how sad he is. And he says, "But," and Olivia's response is, "Whoever you are, just go, please, just go." And he, Miles jumps off, swings off. 3 days later, they're at the funeral. Miles is apologizing to Olivia, saying, "I'm so sorry. I don't know, you know, what to say." And Olivia tells him, "You don't have to say sorry, Miles. What could you have done?" And we see Miles there standing at the graveside of his friend with tears in his eyes. Then he goes to his Uncle Aaron and says, "You're wrong, Uncle Aaron. It matters where you got it. It matters to me." And he gives the money back. And his Uncle Aaron's response is, "Watch yourself out there. You see one of those things coming, you run the other way." And Miles stops and turns and says, "See you later, Uncle Aaron. Be good, okay?" And then we return to present day, back to the Mark Bagley illustrated story, as Miles stings Morbius, the living vampire, with his spider sting, and says, "You're not a bad guy, Doc. The world hurt you and you gave up on it. Life makes that an easy thing to do, but it's not the right thing to do." And the living vampire Morbius' response is, "Who are you to tell me what's right and what's wrong?" And Miles says, I'm just a kid who spends his birthday sending you to vampire prison. See you later, Doc. And Morbius says, I can smell the doubt on you. You're a scared child in a mask. And Miles' response is, yep. And he thinks to himself, and sometimes I fail. I can't help everyone. I can't make the world fair. But a hero isn't the one who always wins. It's the one who always tries. Tonight, I'm trying. Not because it's something I should do, but because this is the night I remember I couldn't save him. I'm not an Avenger. I'm not Thor or Cap or Peter. I'm just a kid in a mask doing the best I can. I'll never give up on the world or the city or anyone that needs me. I'm Miles Morales. I'm Spider-Man. So I think it's a really well done story as far as the structure of the story, with Miles remembering those words that his uncle had told him. Because he did learn the lesson himself, right? I mean, it wasn't Uncle Ben being killed by a killer that he let run by him, right? Like the way Spider-Man learned the lesson. It was a much subtler way for him to learn that he was needed, basically. But just because he was willing to put his life on the line, he was willing to fight those Skrulls, it doesn't mean he can save everybody. It doesn't mean it's perfect. He still fails, but the hero is the one who tries. So is the world broken down to its center? Maybe. Anyone who teaches you can't change that is a liar or a fool? Well, maybe. Maybe they are, but Miles is still going to try, and that's what makes him a hero. So I feel like it's a very, very well done story. Expertly written by Brian Edward Hill. I think this is his first Marvel work. I'm not 100% on that. But I feel like he really gets who Miles is at his core. So incredible job by Brian Edward Hill. The art is spectacular throughout. It's got a very kinetic style, both in the flashback and the present day. I mean, Mark Bagley, consummate Spider-Man artist, but even Nelson Blake II and Alethea Martinez do a great job in the flashback story of making it feel really kinetic. And I think, I'm pretty sure Nelson Blake II was the artist that did the Top Cow title Romulus with Brian Edward Hill. That was also a really, really good story. So this was fun. It was fun to see kind of a flashback story of Miles, before he even had a costume, really. He's wearing this stylish hoodie, didn't even have a proper costume, didn't have any training, had maybe didn't even quite understand his powers. So I thought it was pretty fun. There's also another story called Right of Way, written by Emily Ryan Lerner, with art by Alberto Albuquerque and colors by Carlos Lopez. And it's more of a present day. It's Donkey, or Genki rather, taking behind the wheel driver's instruction with a teacher from his school. And while he's doing that, Miles is in the car as well, waiting for his turn. They run into a guy who hijacked an 18-wheeler. And it's a fun story, but it's kind of a bit of a throwaway. It certainly doesn't have any like lasting impact or anything. I have a feeling it was more there to maybe to give those creators a chance to see what they could do on a Marvel story, as well as to probably lengthen the book because it is an annual, so you want it to be a little bit bigger. But the reason this issue shines is 100% the narrative by Brian Edward Hill, with the excellent art by the art team in that first story. And we do get a little tease from the editor, Chris Robinson, that we may see some more of these, how does he put it, secret stories of Miles' early days. Let me take a quick look here and let you know exactly what it says. Yes, who knows what other secret histories we have in store. So, I wouldn't mind seeing a few more of these type stories, especially with this kind of ad hoc pre-costume, as Chris Robinson puts it, that Nelson Blake II designed. It's very reminiscent of what somebody would throw together in this situation, a hoodie zipped all the way up, some jeans, some boots, some gloves. It works really, really well. So Again, I thought this was spectacular. I remember being kind of unsure when they first announced Miles Morales as another Spider-Man, but they've done an incredible job of all the writers who've ever worked on him, from Brian Michael Bendis, who created him, to Brian Edward Hill, who's written his latest adventure. They've done a really great job of everybody has of staying very true to the character. And I think he's great. And I love the fact that we're finally going to see him on the big screen in the upcoming Spider-Man animated movie. So I definitely recommend this issue. Thought it was spectacular. The Fantastic Four issue was great as well. So as always, I want to thank everybody for joining me. Please tell your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help us with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on iTunes. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available there, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. Quick reminder, next show I'll be at is Comic-Con Palm Springs, coming up the last weekend in August, so hope to see you there. Once again, I want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.